a school administrator at the center of a firestorm over the racial climate at Boston's most elite exam school, is leaving. After leading Boston Latin School for 9 years, the headmaster, Lynn Mooney Tata, will step down once classes end on Friday. It's a decision that's taken the school and city officials by surprise, WBUR's Louise Kennedy reports.
There have been calls for Tata's resignation since soon after students began speaking out against the racial climate at Boston Latin. But she has stayed on, with the backing of Boston Superintendent of Schools, Tommy Chang. Her decision to step aside now was not something students, such as Philip Sosu, who graduated last week, expected.
It just came out of left field, sort of, because she's taken steps to repair, you know, what has come out. The BLS racial climate isn't nearly as bad as it was made out to be in the media.
School officials insist no one requested Tata's resignation. Superintendent Chang says he learned of her decision just yesterday.
I have always supported her and her leadership to build a more inclusive environment at this school, but this was a personal decision and I accepted her resignation.
Teachers at the meeting where Lynn Mooney Tata revealed her plans say many people in the room were shocked and in tears. But her decision is welcome news to critics who say school administrators have not done enough to change the culture at Boston Latin, even after learning about students using racial epithets and threatening violence. Among those who have been asking for Tata's resignation is Kevin Peterson, director of the New Democracy Coalition.
I think while the headmaster is well-meaning and competent in many ways, she handled this issue poorly.
The district found the school's response to one threat inadequate and suspended Tata for 2 days in April. The school remains the subject of a federal civil rights investigation. The students who launched the Black at BLS campaign to raise awareness in January say in a statement that they were, quote, just as shocked as the general public to learn of the resignation.
I don't know that Lynn's resignation is going to change anything immediately. But it was a shock and it was a surprise.
City Councilor Andrea Campbell graduated from Latin and worked with students there when the complaints surfaced. She and other Latin alumni plan to meet Saturday to discuss how to improve the racial climate at the school, a concern she says goes far beyond just Boston Latin.
There are issues that have come up at other schools in the district. For me, it's about looking at this in a bigger context. Otherwise, we'll be back in this space again, not with Latin, but with another school.
At the same time, the prestigious exam school that's sending 28 seniors to Harvard in the fall is looking for a new leader. Superintendent Tommy Chang says the next headmaster must be able to address the school's racial climate, but must also be ready to carry the Boston Latin legacy forward. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Louise Kennedy.
A strike looms Monday for unionized nurses at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Negotiators have so far been unable to resolve differences over pay, benefits, and staffing levels in contract talks that have so far failed. Hospital operators say they need to cut costs and improve care, but the nurses say this should not come at the expense of nurses or patient care. For some big-picture context on this, and for a look at the role that hospital nurses play at Brigham and Women's and other hospitals, we're joined this morning by Maureen Bisignano, President Emerita and Senior Fellow at the Cambridge-based Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Good morning, Maureen, and welcome.
Good morning, Bob.
All right. First of all, from the hospital point of view, as technology has improved, hospitals are looking to improve healthcare and the methods they employ, but it's all very expensive, costing money. So what are the major costs that hospitals face right now?
Well, these are really challenging times, I think, for hospital leaders and for staff. We're facing a pace of change that's really unprecedented. As you mentioned, we're looking at the implementation of electronic records, but we're also looking at a pace of research and changing care guidelines that I've never seen before. We're also looking at new technologies, new medications. So costs indeed are rising for hospitals at a time when costs in the United States especially are already too high and do need to be controlled.
Do hospitals across the country feel sometimes that the only place that they can go to try and save money as they try to improve health care is to look to its workforce?
Well, the workforce is in most hospitals the largest expense, but obviously, the workforce is such a critical piece of providing safe care. I think a lot of times leaders feel a little bit less able to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies or other technology vendors, but it's really a challenging time for leaders, I think.
All right. Now, from the nurses' point of view, what's the role of nurses in this changing healthcare environment, and what stresses are they under?
Nursing is perhaps the only profession that I know that's intellectually challenging, physically demanding, and emotionally draining at the same time. And yet nurses are, in my experience, the key people to provide good care for patients because they see the patients across the entire system. They're able to put the whole picture together.
One of the sticking points in this particular set of contract talks between nurses and the hospital Brigham and Women's is wages and benefits. I assume that's a major issue at other hospitals as well.
It is. It's perhaps the first time in history that we've had five distinct generations working in the same workforce. We've got very diverse workforces, multi-ethnic and multi-racial workforces, and we've got multi-professional workforces. So it may be an issue of wages, but it's also a major change in healthcare where we're going from individual care to team-based care. And it's how do we incentivize, how do we reward teams as well as individuals?
If there is a nurses' strike at Brigham and Women's in Boston on Monday, it would be the first nurses' strike in Boston in 30 years. Given the pressures that both sides feel, could there be more strikes across the country down the road?
I think we are seeing these kind of challenges raised across the country. I certainly hope that we can move beyond this and figure out a way to understand the challenges of working together without strikes. I think that both sides feel the need to put their foot down at the moment. But for the best care for patients, I think resolving these kind of challenges in a different way will be the best.
Maureen Bisignano, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning and helping us to understand.
Thank you, Bob.
Maureen Bisignano is a registered nurse, also president emerita, and a senior fellow at the Cambridge-based Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Peanuts, milk, eggs, words that trigger panic for some parents, teachers, and kids. Today, an estimated 1 in 13 children in this country has a food allergy, a rate that's increased 50% since 1997. No one seems to know why. The only treatment outside of a hospital emergency room is an EpiPen, which four moms you're about to meet carry in bulk. These women have turned their frustration into fundraising and a plan for a new research effort at the Broad Institute in Cambridge that launches today. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has the story.
We'll start in a clinic at Boston Children's Hospital. Leslie Solomon, a mom from Brookline, was there with her 6-year-old son, who's allergic to milk. The boy's doctor thought he might be able to tolerate milk baked in, say, a muffin.
If you can have baked milk, it helps you grow out of your milk allergy.
Solomon agreed to try what's known in the world of food allergies as a food challenge.
Part of the way that they can tell you if you have an allergy is you have to eat the food.
There are tests that show whether a child is at risk for an allergic reaction. But to confirm an allergy and gauge the severity, you have to ingest some of the food that could kill you. So Solomon made muffins at home with milk, following a hospital recipe. She brought a muffin to the hospital and fed her son a tiny bite there in a clinic for this medical test.
And he failed it miserably. He went into anaphylaxis.
Solomon's son turned bright red. His throat closed up.
It was very emotional. It was very scary. We're on our way down to the emergency room after two EpiPens. He still couldn't breathe.
As Solomon's son recovered, she sat by his bedside, scouring the web, thinking there must be a better way to diagnose a food allergy. She vowed to find one and help bring it to market. That's Solomon's day job. She's director of the Innovation Hub at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Solomon tracked down the experts in food allergies, assuming they'd know what tools and treatments were in the pipeline. But she kept hearing the same thing.
There's just not enough basic science yet.
Here's what we know about food allergies from Aviv Regev, a biologist at MIT and the Broad Institute.
We know that for some reason our body senses the food, and for some reason it thinks that it is something horrible. And not only does it think it's something horrible, it thinks that the right response to it is to go completely berserk. We don't really know why.
In fact, says Regev, there are lots of why questions scientists have not answered about food allergies.
We don't know why certain substances and not others, and we especially don't know why some people but not others, and we don't really understand the full chain of events that leads to this chain reaction. If we did know, we might be able to stop it.
Last fall, Solomon connected with three other moms of young children, two who are doctors and an attorney for a Boston hedge fund. These women, who are well-connected in the world of medicine and finance in Boston, began gathering weekly and talking and emailing about a plan to stop the terror of food allergies.
Thank you. Can I bring the coffee?
Thank you so much.
During breakfast meetings, these moms organized a symposium in Boston of top food allergy researchers. Experts in genetics, allergy and immunology, and the microbiome continued meeting. They eventually formed a core group of six scientists. The moms raised nearly $10 million through family members and the Richard and Susan Smith Family Foundation to launch the Food Allergy Science Initiative.
So the scientists met last week and are finalizing their research plan.
Dr. Christine Olson, a radiation oncologist at Mass General, updates her fellow moms at a Friday morning meeting.
But what they've developed so far is almost four pillars of research that they're going to look into,
including which cells are involved in a food allergy response, how they react to different foods, how they relay messages, and why cells learn to tolerate foods when children outgrow an allergy. The scientists will also look at environmental and genetic factors. Eventually, they aim to find a better way to diagnose and treat food allergies. Right now, the guidance from many doctors is avoid any dangerous foods and carry an EpiPen at all times, which Olson says some parents are reluctant to use.
The EpiPen is scary, right? They have to take this needle and they have to jam it into their child's thigh and hold it there for 10 seconds while their child is having trouble breathing. I've done it before my child. It's a terrible thing to have to do.
The moms are hoping for some fast results. The scientists say it will take 3 to 5 years to understand food allergies at the cellular level. Dr. Wayne Schreffler, who heads the Food Allergy Center at Mass General, is one of the six scientists in this group.
The promise is really that by focusing on that fundamental level, we'll be in a position to discover some more transformative changes in therapy someday or in diagnosis.
There have been many ideas over the years about why there's a steady increase in the rate of food allergies. One theory suggests a food allergy is an inappropriate immune response. But that's not the view of Ruslan Mejitov, who will lead the Food Allergy Science Initiative. He sees a connection between food allergies and the body's defense mechanisms.
This is an exaggerated version of a normal defensive reaction that operates to screen food that we consume.
Mejitov says the body may be overreacting because foods these days are so carefully screened and preserved that the body can't always tell what's good and what's bad. The answer, he says, may be to return to more whole foods, although they may not be as pretty or as tasty.
I definitely try to avoid refined foods. It's just not part of general culture yet, but it's something that hopefully will become soon. I think the battle here would be with food industry primarily.
And all of us who look for the most beautiful fruit and the most brilliant white bread. But that's getting ahead of the story. For now, there's excitement that the field of food allergies, which has lagged behind so many other conditions, will get a needed boost. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says he expects good things from this initiative.
When you have something that jump starts in an area and brings in new people with resources and funding, that in and of itself creates an acceleration to the field that is needed at this point.
In the meantime, moms and dads, babysitters, and school nurses will keep arming themselves with EpiPens, hoping they'll get through today without needing to reach for one while calling 911 in a panic. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Advances in the understanding of the intelligence of animals has caused a re-examination of how we treat them, such as chimps used for research or elephants who used to perform at circuses. It all has Cognoscenti commentator Rich Barlow worrying about the emotional life of his son's goldfish.
One dog, two cats, a gecko, a frog, and a goldfish. Our 11-year-old soft spot for creatures came with a naturalist's fascination with life forms. No more animals, I've pleaded over the years, in vain. Recently, though, I endured multiple trips to the pet store to acquire more living things, not to mention headaches over assembling still more new pet contraptions. This time, though, I had only myself to blame. Or maybe I should blame bioethicist Jessica Pierce. A column she wrote about animal cognition in the New York Times really got to me. Pierce's assertion that goldfish are more sensitive than we assume, that they exhibit socially complex behaviors, as she put it, made me wince. We kept our goldfish as a tiki in solitary confinement in an unadorned fishbowl less than a foot in diameter. Turns out Pierce had done the same with hers and felt guilt over it. Now, wondering if our goldfish was depressed, I felt guilty too. I stunned my wife and delighted my son by proposing that we get a bigger home and some companions for Azatiki. Second thoughts crept in after three separate trips to the pet store for missing filter parts and a lost fish care brochure. For decades, animal rights activists have denounced everything from factory farming to enforced captivity of wild animals. Now, the science on animal cognition is helping make their case a tough one to contest. Meanwhile, weeks after relocating to bigger digs, Azatiki and company seem to be thriving, insofar as we can tell.
Rich Barlow writes for BU Today and is a contributor to WBUR's ideas and opinion page, Cognoscenti. Check out his essays and many others at WBUR.org. It's time again for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the lives of ordinary people who've passed. This morning, writer Alyssa Eli remembers a New Hampshire teacher who died at a young age.
A few weeks after Danielle Benedict died, her mother, Missy Darcy, visited the Discovery Child Enrichment Center in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Danielle had worked there since she was 18, first as daycare staff and then as a lead teacher, caring for hundreds of children through the years. The staff gave Missy a jar.
And on it, they had put precious memories, and there was a rainbow ribbon tied around it. And they had cut out strips of colored paper, and they had left the paper and pens for parents, kids, daycare workers, anybody that came in, they could just write a memory of Danielle.
It was exactly the kind of project Danielle would have created.
Danielle, thank you so much for caring for our twins and the beluga. They are so comfortable with you, just like with parents. It's definitely not the same without you.
Danielle worked in the beluga room with 2 to 3-year-olds, but most of her career was in the infant room, caring for the little stars. Often, she was the first person parents trusted their newborn to. There might be up to 16 babies in the room. Each teacher was assigned 4. It was like minding quadruplets, a sleepless image. But for Danielle, it was sustenance.
She just loved kids. She wanted to make a difference in those children's lives, and did.
She understood each infant with specificity, this one more tearful, that one more cuddly. But it was specificity without judgment.
Her coworkers had said it didn't matter how difficult they were. She found something special about each one of them.
Danielle's son and daughter went to the Discovery Child Enrichment Center, too. On breaks, she used to peek into their windows, a shadow mother. Then she would go back to the little stars. In the precious memory jar, some parents had written to her children.
Just as I always arrived at DCEC the same time as you and your mom. You usually walked in front of her, and your mom would carry your things. Her hair usually in a high, tight bun. She always watched you lovingly as you headed in the building to start your day, as I'm sure she does now.
Children wrote on colored strips, too, some with just their names, some with Danielle's name and the word love.
There's so many. The jar is full. So we can read them when we feel like it.
The jar sits on a counter in Missy's house. Strips of memory for Danielle's parents and children, husband and siblings, nieces and nephews. Memories for the ones who wrote them, too.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Danielle Benedict, who died in her Manchester, New Hampshire home last year at the age of 32. To suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. The Remembrance Project is a production of the WBUR iLab.